Hi everyone. Thank you all for coming on a quite cold November evening, or I guess early late afternoon. I think the way this will work is I will introduce Scott. He will speak for a bit. Richard will then introduce Ian, who will speak for a bit. And I think there'll be time for questions at the end. Great. So Scott Peterson is the inaugural Bingham Research Fellow in Cultural Studies at Balliol. He's a more recent arrival in Oxford, having practiced as a lawyer in the US for a number of years before coming to do a DPhil in politics. That DPhil looked at changes in the legal status of the three national churches in the UK in the period shortly after the First World War. More broadly, his research focuses on US and UK constitutional history relating to church-state relations and freedom of religion. His work combines history and law with political science, as is evident in the book, and thus should provide a basis for a fascinating talk. And give it up, Scott.
Thanks, Max. And I want to start out by congratulating, this is also the inaugural for the Nuffield LGBTQ group. Yeah. We have the Q on the end, which has not existed before, but will exist from now on, and this is a chance to inaugurate it with bells on. I just want to say a few things tonight, briefly, and not go into huge amounts of detail about what's a fairly long, maybe even diffuse argument in the book. But the book started in 2010 through 12 when Ian and I were working on some policy questions for the Quakers, among others, in relation to the issue of blessing same-sex relationships in religious premises. When the civil partnership statute was approved, it did not include any provision for, and in fact, it specifically barred any kind of religious recognition of same-sex relationships. And when the Equalities Act 2010 was being debated, one of the members of the House of Lords introduced an amendment to allow religious premises to host blessings of same-sex partnerships, civil partnerships, and that eventually passed. And one of the things that got started a kind of a snowball where Ian was involved in, I think that was the letter to the Times, wasn't it? And there were some things going on behind the scenes, as Ian is fond of engaging in that sort of play. There was a transition where the Labour members were whipped when they had not expected to be, and no one expected that to happen. So a number of things happened during that. And then 2012 came along, and I had finished projects that I was working on, and I had a summer after a hard year of work and was kind of floating around wondering what to do next. And I thought, I know, let's just do a book. That would be fun. And that is the last time that I will ever utter that sentence. It was fun, but I had not done one before, and I was not always quite prepared for the amount of investment that was involved in it. But the book is aimed, it's not supposed to be a fundamental groundbreaking work of academic proportion. It is supposed to be a book for policymakers and educated lay people, simply addressing some of the pro and con arguments about marriage from a historical perspective. And we did some archive research, but mostly it's based on secondary sources, but it's an effort to kind of simplify some of these arguments and to argue that there are some things that just aren't worth fighting about in this area. Nick Bamforth is going to be here in a little bit, I think, and we've cited him on this issue. One of the big positions that people take is this, there is something called the new natural law, which has become kind of fashionable in the last few years as a way of justifying opposition to same-sex marriage. And Nick has written at least one full book and another large chunks of a second one, just pretty well demolishing the entire concept of new natural law. But what we wanted to do was to shift that, along with saying that new natural law wasn't something that could really be offered in a public space as a justification for opposing same-sex marriage. What we wanted to do was to set that up against Rawlsian public reason as a way that we can talk about those kinds of things in policy terms. So we tried to take a neutral approach. I think we were broadly sympathetic, certainly, with same-sex marriage because I think we're both liberals who think that this kind of behavior is something that can be regulated in good ways and bad ways. But I think that we were trying to shift the dialogue so that it was based more on facts, both from the UK and from history and from other countries around the world even. And our fundamental conclusion is that the church or religion just doesn't and can't have a monopoly on marriage and can't be the fundamental basis for regulating marriage because it determines so many civil rights. So that for those civil rights to depend on religious criteria and religious institutions is an unworkable set of principles. At the same time, though, I think we've pushed really hard on the issue of religious freedom, because I think that the state ignores religious freedom issues at its peril. And so if anything, I think that we've pushed beyond the boundaries, certainly of, say, the same-sex marriage law in the UK, in terms of saying there are some considerations that one might want to take into account that would allow for even broader protection of religious groups than are available here in the UK. Those are not uncontested kinds of areas. There's no clear way to make those decisions. Those are pretty obviously policy decisions that the legislature and policymakers need to make. But there is room for making them in very generous kinds of ways. The flashpoint for the book basically is 1753, when a moral panic in England, if I can use that phrase, caused people to become extremely concerned about inter-class marriage. Members in the legislature, the statute was, it's now known as Lord Hardwicke's Act. It was the Marriage Act of 1753. And it was the first time when marriage was generally regulated in the UK by a statute for everyone. There were statutes about royal marriages before that, but not statutes that regulated everyone's marriage, the popular marriage. And that came about because there were a number of people who were going to the area around the Fleet Prison in London, and there were defrocked priests down there who would conduct marriages for very little money. They would make up fraudulent records, and there was a lot of confusion about who was married and who wasn't. And of course, this is really detrimental in a society that depends on marriage to determine where property descends and who is the parent of children and those kinds of matters. Before 1753, marriage had basically been a matter where a couple could enter into an agreement just privately, and as long as they said the right words to one another, they were married, even without witnesses. And of course, so once we have 1753, that all changes, and effectively there's a monopoly that's held by the Church of England on marriage in this country, and it lasts until 1836. And to be married, you had to go to a Church of England minister, and he had to perform the service between 8 in the morning and noon with the doors open. And if you were under 21, you had to have parental permission. And if any of those things were lacking, the marriage was void, which means it never had existed. And so if for some reason some technical problem arose later and one of the parties could claim that the marriage was void, it was as if they had never been married. So the children were illegitimate, no money that had changed hands was allowed to stay where it was, and the whole, as you can see, that becomes a way of structuring relationships so that it makes it possible to have a divorce as well, but it's not a very pleasant divorce to have if you have to pretend that the marriage wasn't there, and you can't solve property issues better than that. Regulating marriage the wrong... Oh, and let me also at that point mention that that statute is very important in the sense that as part of the statute, it's necessary to give exemptions to three groups. And the Quakers get an exemption, as do Jews and Scots. One of the reasons the Quakers and the Jews get... Well, I'll let Ian can speculate about the reason that the Scots get their exemption once I've had a shot at it. The Jews and the Quakers are easier to understand because, for one thing, they had been maintaining their own records for some time, and they were reliable records. More importantly, both of those groups practiced endogamy at that point, so there was no risk that Quakers or Jews were going to marry wealthy people and get their money from them. So as a purely class-preserving measure, the 1753 Act didn't need to address Quaker or Jewish marriage. The Scots are a little bit different question. Lord Hardwick actually drafted a bill that would have applied to Scotland. It's really not clear from the evidence that I've seen whether that the failure of that bill had to do with the fact that it was politically impossible by the time he introduced it for it to pass, or whether it was just resistance from the Scots and from powerful Scottish elites who weren't as worried about intermarriage for one reason or another as their English counterparts were. So the normative position, as I said in the book, is broadly sympathetic with same-sex marriage. The broader protections that we argue for have been implemented in other jurisdictions. New York, for example, has passed its statute. We're now up to, as I understand, I think it's 16 in the U.S. Is that in addition to or with the District of Columbia? Do you know?
By my count, we have to recount every week.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Including Illinois and Hawaii, it's 16, including also the District of Columbia, I think.
Okay.
So I'm wrong.
Is that right?
16 out of 51.
I think that's right. But one of the things that's happened in the U.S. is because this has happened on a jurisdiction-by-jurisdiction basis, it's a fairly neat test about how it works out when it happens in different ways. And so one of the things that's fairly clear from the U.S. is when the judiciary come in and say that it's necessary to have same-sex marriage, there aren't religious exemptions normally, unless Connecticut, I think, is the exception to that because they gave the legislature time to pass a bill. But in many cases where the courts just say you're going to have same-sex marriage, there aren't broad religious exemptions. In states like New York, where the legislature passes the law, you get very broad religious exemptions, including in New York, the statute says that organizations don't have to sell property. Religious organizations don't have to sell property for purposes that are inconsistent with their principles. So you have the Roman Catholic Church, for example, doesn't have to sell property if it is afraid that it's going to be used for same-sex marriage. Now you can see that there are serious problems with those kinds of exemptions, those religious exemptions. And while we push them in the book, we're also, I think, both aware that they undercut a lot of work that's been done by LGBT people over the past few decades, trying to make sure that, trying to limit the amount of discrimination that goes on. And so by making discrimination against same-sex couples legitimate, giving these broad exemptions undercuts the anti-discrimination principle. So it's a serious tension. But it's a dangerous one because on the one hand you have people's integrity that's at stake on the LGBT side. On the other side, you have people who really do have as one of their fundamental values something like the ability to be either a martyr or to say that they have in some sense been that they're willing to stand up for a principle even at great cost. Let me say it that way. Back really quickly to the preservation of cleavages issue. 1753, that statute was designed to protect class, to make sure that heiresses weren't marrying stable boys and so vice versa, that heirs weren't marrying maids. And the importance of maintaining that is obvious from the debates that took place at the time, because many of the people who were against the act were also people who had enjoyed a marriage to someone of a much higher class than they were. A couple of them had married after first having very bad illegitimate relationships with heiresses when they were tutors in houses, that sort of thing. That did not stop any of these people from making the argument that the old way of having marriage was what God had intended and that the legislature shouldn't interfere, that the 1753 Act interfered in what should be a religious institution. The status quo that was most important in the United States, along parallel lines, is the cleavage along racial lines. And until 1967, there were a number of states in the U.S. that forbade interracial marriage. So these are just two examples of the way that existing institutions in the past, come on, Simon, how existing institutions in the past were being protected by having marriage laws that were rigid and were enforced by the government, as well as by the church. Let me just finish up with a few statistics about marriage. British social attitudes, or about same-sex marriage, and British social attitudes surveys over the past 20 years have shown a substantial change in people's attitudes towards same-sex relationships. So in 1987, when people were asked whether same-sex marriages were wrong, always, mostly, sometimes, rarely, or not, 75% of the respondents answered that they were mostly or always wrong in 1987, but by 2007 that number had come down to 36%. So the attitudes are substantially changing on the ground, and our argument, I think, is that the cleavage that runs parallel to race and to class in the other two cases in contemporary society is actually gender. And so the whole marriage issue, the reason that that is so inflammatory now is that there is a gender cleavage that's being preserved. And so the next question is, can this serve as a driver for change? And the question is, and this has been asked by a number of people, will there be backlash if, for example, the U.S. Supreme Court decides that same-sex marriage is a fundamental right that all states need to recognize for same-sex couples? Of course, this is trying to predict something that hasn't happened yet, but on the basis of past experience, one thing that we can look to, the traditional place to look would be, of course, Roe versus Wade, the abortion case, where the U.S. Supreme Court arguably got way out in front of public opinion and froze it so that public opinion remained very divided on the issue, and we now have radicalized Republican and Democrat parties in part because of that frozen status of opinion on abortion. On the issue of same-sex marriage, though, we also might want to think about Loving versus Virginia, which is back to my original question about racial divides. And in 1968, only 20% of Gallup, this is the year after Loving versus Virginia, in 1968, only 20% of Gallup respondents approved of interracial marriage. And majority approval for interracial marriage in the United States didn't come until 1991. So it continued to move forward for a long time after the Supreme Court had decided that this was something, it didn't freeze, is the bottom line here. By 2007, 77% approved. But we've still got, I think it's 17% that disapproves. So the point here is that not all cases are like Roe versus Wade, where a backlash comes about when the Supreme Court makes a bold decision. And it may well be that the Supreme Court had more room to decide this past June and July, June, than it did. So I think that's basically a picture of some of the arguments that we're making. There's a lot more detail, of course. We also discuss the case of Canada and South Africa and how in those two countries, same-sex marriage is rooted in issues like the history of apartheid in South Africa and with religious issues in Canada. We spend some time talking about Ireland, which is always an interesting place in so many ways. And of course, the history there is a lot, it's still the religious cleavage that you run up against where, you know, something with the Anglican Church monopoly in England, you have the same sort of thing there. But there, of course, the religious cleavage is a lot more violent than it is. There was a death penalty for Roman Catholic priests who married Protestants and Catholics. in the 18th century in Ireland. There was one member of the clergy who was actually put to death for that. He was a serial offender, so it was not. He kept doing it over and over and over. So you don't, the sympathy on that is a little bit limited. But anyway, there's a great deal more in the book. I'm hoping that there are not mistakes. I'm hoping very much that it's not boring. And if you do want to buy one, we have some here. But I hope even if you check it out of a library and read it, it's something that you'll enjoy and profit from, and that it won't have been something that was done. We had hoped that it was designed to influence debates in Westminster and Holyrood. We are barely on the edge of being able to maybe make some impact in Holyrood, but of course Westminster, that statute just slid through like slicker than almost anything you can imagine, and so even though there were a lot of people posturing about opposition to it, there was just very little chance to do it, and so we were a little late for that one, but when you do these instant kinds of projects, that's one of the risks you take. So. Anyway, thank you all very much for coming, and I think Richard is going to introduce Ian, who will tell you gossip.
These are for both of you as well.
Oh, thanks.
Yes, thank you very much, Scott, for that very interesting sort of historical context there. Let me introduce Ian. Ian McLean is University Professor of Politics and Official Fellow in Politics at Nuffield. A native of Scotland, Ian completed his undergraduate through DPhil here in Oxford, and while most of his career has been spent at this university, Ian has also taught at Newcastle, at Warwick, and has had visiting professorships in the US and in Australia. Ian has a wide array of research interests, including electoral systems, constitutional reform, and matters of church and state. He's produced a number of timely books, this being one of them, but of course others, including recently he co-authored Scotland's Choice about the referendum. He's written books on what's wrong with the British Constitution and co-authored a book on the Church of England and States of the USA. So he'll no doubt be bringing those expertise and others to his talk today. So thank you very much, Ian.
Thank you very much, Richard. I don't want the formal part of the proceedings to go on for very long, so I'm going to talk about two subjects, Scotland and religious freedom. There's a slight connection, but this may or may not become clear in my remarks. So, first of all, to explain among other things, why we're having this published by Edinburgh University Press, the main launch, if EUP's publicity were on the ball, which we suspect they're not, would by now already have taken place in Edinburgh and will at some time take place in Edinburgh, just possibly before the Scottish Bill gets royal assent. But since our publishers were rather slow-moving, we decided to have a rest of the world launch here, and many thanks to Max and Richard and their colleagues for allowing us to hijack their event for this purpose. So, those of you who already have copies, or who might shortly be acquiring them, will see on page 96, rather poor quality reproduction, unfortunately, of an image which I really love, and I wanted to have it on the front cover, but the designers reasonably said, nobody except Scots will have a clue what this is about. So this is Victorian illustration, illustrated London News or similar, of an eloping couple married in the smithy at Gretna Green. Now, this needs quite a lot of deconstruction. First of all, where the hell is Gretna Green? It is a small village just on the Scottish side of the Anglo-Scottish border. If I tell you that currently 17% of all marriages contracted in Scotland are contracted in this one small village, which is, by the way, utterly full of tourist tat, and if you're tempted to come off the motorway to Gretna, I would say don't bother. However, the Gretna marriage anomaly, as Lord Hardwicke saw it, dates back to at least 1753 and to Hardwicke's failure to get a Scottish Act through the UK Parliament at the same time as the English one. And I think his failure was because there had only just been a military revolt in Scotland, the Jacobite Rebellion of 45,
and Hardwick was warned, in effect, that he did not have the votes for it. So Scottish marriage law was never assimilated to the England and Wales pattern. And for reasons which are not for tonight, but which are in the book, it had evolved differently ever since medieval times, and those differences were preserved in the Act of Union of 1707, which preserved, among other things, Scots private law, and marriage law is part of that, to be forever distinct, as it still is. So, as soon as technology made it a bit easier, there were stagecoaches, or I guess you could take a packet boat to Carlisle, the people whom Hardwick was trying to get at, as Scott says, stable boys marrying heiresses, or rich men marrying maids, in either case, if one of the parties was under 21, could evade the regulations by going to Scotland, and they did. And they have continued to do so, although mostly now Gretna marriages, it's just ceremonial. It's a bit like Vegas marriages. It's a place where people know that it's fashionable to go to get married. This story explains, at least to us, and we're hoping to persuade you, that it really matters that Scotland is different. And I know that some of you know that I'm a complete broken record on the subject, but I talk about constitutional matters or a lot of the time. I spend a lot of, I live in England. I spend a lot of my time talking to British constitutional lawyers who, forgive me, Nick, are mostly English constitutional lawyers and who talk about the British Constitution when they actually mean the English Constitution. And I make a career of saying, excuse me, Scotland is different, Northern Ireland is different as well. And I will embarrass Scott just by saying, by telling one anecdote. When Scott applied to our department to do a PhD on church state and what would be the First Amendment if it existed here, i.e. the US First Amendment saying Congress shall make no law establishing religion, respecting the establishment of a religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. I don't know, I think Scott does know that you nearly didn't get in because we thought there was nobody in the department qualified to supervise this, so I volunteered, and luckily we've had a partnership which has worked very well since then. But in our first email exchanges, I said to Scott, you know Scotland is different. And it's fair to say that Scott wasn't fully aware of that at that point, before he arrived. I can now say that he is at least the second best informed person in the UK about church and state matters in Scotland. And we're very pleased that the very best person informed on these matters, the former clerk deputy of the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland, has, and I think it's very kind of her and also rather courageous because the issues that this book deals with are controversial in Scotland, has given us an endorsement. So, that's Scotland. Scotland is different, and when eventually we have the world, as opposed to the rest of the world, launch of this book, we will say some of the same things in Edinburgh. Okay, so that's Scotland. Religious freedom. Scott said I would tell some stories, and I will. I'm taking the opportunity to reflect on the recent history from the point of view of UK politics. As Scott says, one of the things which underlies this is a quite astonishing change in public attitudes, as recorded notably by British social attitudes. I think the most rapid change in social attitudes on anything that any of us know about. Were the politicians in front or behind? It doesn't particularly matter. I would say they were probably slightly behind. But of course, it's interactive. Public opinion changes, so politicians change, so public opinion changes some more. Reflecting on the events that Scott described, I'm now seeing as crucial is an intervention which actually now feels as if it was more momentous than we thought it was at the time. And this was early 2010, and as Scott mentioned, the Alley amendment to the Equality Bill was in Parliament. Lord Alley is a Labour backbencher, or as the Daily Mail puts it, the openly gay Muslim Labour peer. So, you know, three hate adjectives all thrown together. Who introduced, off his own bat, an amendment to the Equality Bill that was then going through Parliament, allowing for civil partnerships to take place on religious premises for those and only those religions which wanted them to. And civil partnerships, when first enacted, had, as Scott said, been forbidden to be enacted on any religious premises. And this was done in order to get civil partnerships through in the first place. And there's another story, which I won't tell now, unless it were to come up in questions, about what the Anglican bishops in the House of Lords said about civil partnerships then, and what they now try to give the impression that they then thought. Which is not clever, because the web exists. Hansard has been online since 1803. So trying now to give the impression that you said something different 6 years ago than you actually said is not a clever move. All right, that's what I said I wouldn't say. Now, the Alley Amendment, although it was not sponsored by, was certainly welcomed by three very small, and I must stress, extremely small, religious groups which wanted to do this, and they conduct civil partnerships on their premises, and they were the Quakers, the Unitarians, and Liberal Judaism. Those three musketeers are now four, because Reform Judaism has joined the group which wants to do this, and others may. All very small. Indeed, as an anti-MP in the Commons debate on the marriage bill, who was on the committee, Jim Shannon, the Democratic Unionist MP, said at one point, I'm sure truly, that there were more people against same-sex marriage in his own constituency than there were in the Quakers, Unitarians, Liberal Judaism, and Reformed Judaism put together. And he may well be right. However, what I think worked extremely well about this campaign was persuading sufficient people that this was not about numbers, it was about religious freedom. And religious freedom, sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. And that for those religions which wanted to do it, it was as much a matter of their commitment and their discernment as the commitment and discernment on the other side was for the admittedly much larger religions which did not want to do it, which thought it was against their religion. So when the Alley Amendment came up in Parliament, I initially offered to get a round robin of professors of politics and similar people. And the first hero of this story, who unfortunately can't be here tonight, Dermot McCulloch, who unfortunately had a bike accident recently, he's a tremendous networker, and I didn't know him well at the time. We met at some social function. I said, would you be interested in being involved in this? Not only was he interested in being involved, but he networked with the ferocity, which one or two of us know about, to ensure that every retired Liberal bishop that he could get hold of, because the atmosphere was such that only one then serving bishop signed the letter, but a number of retired bishops and deans did, to the extent that this letter, which I wrote, became mentioned in the parliamentary debates as the bishop's letter. I was absolutely fine by that. You know, exercising influence in an indirect way is absolutely fine. And the bishop's letter, as it became known, we think may have been instrumental, perhaps not in the passage of the Alley Amendment, but in its passage by the completely unanticipated margin of 95 to 21 in the Lords. So fast forward a couple of years, and we get the present bill now enacted. And here is a possible mystery to which I think I have a possible solution. When the government issued a white paper, white or green, I can't remember its colour, the consultation paper anyway, saying that it was proposing to enact same-sex marriage, it did not invite responses as to whether it should do this, but only responses as to how it should do this. If he thought that this would cut off the anti-side, it was sorely disappointed, because something like not quite half of the responses answered the whether question saying no. But at any rate, when proposed, the bill said, as civil partnerships initially had done about 6 years earlier, that there would be no provision for religious celebrants to conduct same-sex marriages. Of course, the four little groups, Quakers, Unitarians, Liberal and Reform Judaism, all complained about this and all said that this was a violation of our religious freedom. I don't think at the time we seriously expected to prevail, because I can remember as late as, I remember it was November, but I can't remember which year. This is all so rapid. We're 2013 now. Yes, I think it was as late as November last year, 2012. As late as November of last year, I was part of a delegation from the four groups to the Home Office, which was within which is the Government Equality Office, which was sponsoring the bill. And they did say, it's very nice to talk to you after some of the other people we've been talking to. But they also said, the government's position is that this is not going to be offered to religious groups. At some time between November last year and I think January of this year, when the bill was published, government flipped and it introduced a bill, a very elaborate bill, so the civil service must have been working them. We know that they were burning the midnight oil over the Christmas break last year, to introduce a bill which did permit those religious communities which wanted to do so, with very elaborate precautions to protect the religious freedom of those that did not want to do it. And this was what the government ministers and spokesmen called the quadruple lock, very soon reduced to a quad lock. This phrase was used in parliamentary debates. I have observed somewhere else that it's an interesting lock which only opens from one side. That's to say, if a faith community decides corporately that it is not going to do same-sex marriage, and an individual minister in conscience wants to do it, that is not permitted. If a religious community corporately decides that it does want to do same-sex marriage, and an individual minister decides in conscience not to, that person is protected from having to do it. So there are, I would say, quite strong protections of conscience, although they're somewhat asymmetric. Now, I'll just finish with a piece of speculation, although I think it's fairly well-grounded speculation. Those of you who have been following this may know that for a very long time now, as long as the issue has been in the public domain, there has been a complaint from the anti-same-sex marriage side saying that this is not whatever Parliament says, whatever the UK Parliament says, this will end up in Strasbourg at the European Court of Human Rights. And, sorry to caricature, but these Europeans, and people like the Daily Mail and the Sun are not always good at discriminating between the European Union and the Council of Europe. This, as everybody in this room knows, relates to the Council of Europe, not to the European Union. Anyway, they're still Europeans, and therefore foreign, and therefore they don't understand the way we do things in this country, and that therefore these Europeans would force unwilling vicars to conduct gay marriages, whatever the law said. Now, we don't think that this complaint has any plausibility, nor did the numerous eminent lawyers who spoke on the matter in the House of Lords. Something which was rarely, if ever, mentioned, I've not traced any open mention of it in the public debates, which we think was crucial, was the case on the other side. That's to say, if the bill had gone through as civil partnerships originally went through, or as it was proposed in the White Paper, that religions would be forbidden, that same-sex marriage would be legalised, which it follows from the theme of our book, which Scott outlined, that the state is perfectly entitled to do that, we maintain. But if the state does it and then forbids religions to do it, then it would be one of these four little groups or their representatives who would go to, well, the British courts in the first instance, and if they had to, ultimately to Strasbourg, to say that that was a breach of our religious freedom under, in particular, Article 9 of the European Convention of Human Rights, which is protecting religious freedom. And unlike the hypothetical case on the other side, we think ours would have succeeded. And we believe that government got legal advice between November last year and January of this year, which led it to change its mind. I wish I could have a smoking gun to present to you, but I don't. So that's all I think either of us has to say about the book. There's plenty of drinks still outside there, and I suggest that anybody who hasn't already get themselves a drink and a nibble, and we are very happy to take questions.